Welcome to Open the Pod Bay Doors. I'm your host today, Ian Gardner. This podcast is brought to you by Innovation Bay. We are a network of tech founders, investors and connectors, and our aim is to support startups on their journey from idea to IPO and beyond. We've been doing this since 2003. We're active across Australia. We've got over 5,000 members. So if you're interested in joining us, please check us out and sign up as a member at innovationbay.com. Now, if you like this podcast, and we really hope you do, please do tell the world about us on social media. And if you're feeling super generous, you could also rate us wherever you listen to your podcast. We love hearing your feedback, so please do let us know how we're doing and who else you might like to hear on the show. We have an awesome guest for you today. I interviewed Colette Grigich, who is the head of startups for Amazon Web Services across Australia and New Zealand. She's a pillar of the startup ecosystem. It's a really cool job that she's got. But before that, she spent 6 years at Blue Chili, that a few of you will have heard of. And she's also got some pretty serious startup chops before that as well. So we definitely get into that. We also get into a bit more about AWS and the job she's doing there. And I should just say, you know, we love AWS, and it's not just because they're a sponsor, it's because they've been a core part of the ecosystem for quite a long time. I actually did Colette's job for 4 years from 2014 to 2018. You know, I was the first guy on the ground running that team or creating that team, and it was an amazing job. I mean, it was really all about building the ecosystem and trying to lean in and help the amazing startups and investors around there. So yeah, we get into a bit more detail about how she's doing the job and how she's thinking about things. And I got to say, like, I really enjoyed the quickfire questions at the end as well. So some good, insightful chat, and it was really engaging. She's a wonderful woman, and I really, really enjoyed my chat with her. So that's enough from me here. Let's go and hear from Colette. All right, welcome. We are back with another episode. I'm in Colette Grigich's house, in fact. I was going to say I was disappointed because I wanted to go back home, but Colette is the head of startups for AWS across Australia and New Zealand, which is a role that I used to do. A few years ago. I did it for 4 years, which is very exciting. And this podcast started in the AWS office. So part of me was quite excited to try and get to the office and see what it's like and get back to the original studio, which was never a studio. But instead, we're doing the working from home dream in Colette's house. So thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thanks for being here, Ian.
I can't tell. The house is remarkably tidy. I don't know whether you were running around crazy because you've got two little kids. So having a house as tidy as this is remarkable. How did you do it?
How did I do it? We have so many things happening in our life that if the house isn't tidy, I can't keep track of anything. So I'm a little OCD when it comes to that. And I'm a closet Martha Stewart.
Right. And what about the, who's that woman that does the get rid of things, the Japanese?
Oh, Marie Kondo.
Yeah.
I should condo my closet, though. That's upstairs, though. Downstairs is good. Upstairs is a different story.
Got it. All right, we're not here to talk about Marie Kondo or other homewares. We want to hear about you and your role. So let's maybe start at the beginning, because you've got a slightly unusual surname and you have a slightly unusual accent. So why don't you tell us about, well, so do I, except for the surname, I suppose. But, you know, we're all immigrants here. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in South Africa in a small little town in the sugarcane country, just north of Durban. So about 2 hours north of Durban. It's a small little place. If you've ever been to Proserpine or North Queensland, that area between Townsville and Cairns, it kind of looks like that. It's very tropical, hot.
Right. So farming?
There are a lot of sugarcane farms, but my parents were engineers.
Gotcha.
So we were town folk in my town of, I think we were 17,000 people or 35 if you counted the informal settlements.
Right, so that's not a huge town, and if it's 2 hours drive north, it's your country living.
Yeah.
And how was it? Did you enjoy it?
Actually, when I think back, the things that I love about it was just the convenience. Like, I played sports and about 20 different sports, and you can go, you know, leave 2 minutes early at the one and show up 2 minutes later at the other one and just pack them in like back to back because everywhere was 5 minutes away.
Yeah.
So, it was lovely. So I grew up in South Africa, warm, hot, humid. My parents immigrated to Canada when I was in year 11. So it was plus 38 in South Africa when we left. It was minus 42 in Canada when we arrived. And I took one look at that and I was like, nah, get me out of here.
So which town was that in Canada you went to?
Far, far north. So if you've ever seen Ice Road Truckers, there's a show on TV somewhere called Ice Road Truckers. And it's in the Arctic Circle, far, far north. Wow. In the Northwest Territories. So close to Yukon and Alaska.
Wow, yeah, you forget how big Canada is. Enormous. I spent an 8-week working period when I was a student, and I was based in Toronto, but we drove up to Timmins, which is about as far north as you go, and it was just this wasteland of it. It was 10 hours drive north. Yeah. And it was just, it was bizarre.
Yeah. And if you've ever done that in the winter, it's just white. It's just white and silent. I think that was the thing that really, coming from Africa, which is like loud and vibrant and every day you could die and you're just like so grateful to be alive, and you get to Canada and it's like silent and white. I'm like, is this the afterlife? So I went to university in Canada. I went to a business school up there. And during that period, did an exchange to Australia because I was just, I think, looking for every reason to get back to the warmth and defrost a little bit. So I went up to Townsville, funny enough.
Oh, yeah.
Went to James Cook Uni there for a semester and ended up meeting this guy who wouldn't leave me alone. And here we are.
Oh, wow. So what, you got married and moved to Sydney? Is that kind of as
got married, traveled a bit. It was pretty quick, though. We got engaged, I think, a year after we met.
Right.
And then married the year after that, did not have a baby the year after that. It took a while. We went traveling and just adventuring around the world. And that's where we actually encountered our first startup idea, not knowing that it was going to be a startup. So
right. And tell us about that. So that was that you and your
Vinko,
husband?
Yeah. So my husband, Vinko, who was an architect at the time, but, you know, design principles. And we were traveling the world and we started noticing that there was this centralized travel happening and not really a lot of connection between travelers and locals. So we had this idea that we could have a website for connecting travelers and locals together. And that was sort of our Airbnb for experiences, our first startup. We came back to Australia to start that. So we're in Brisbane in our living room. Husband runs in one day and goes, babe, I just read a blog and I think what we're doing is called a startup.
And what year was this?
This was 2010.
Okay. So it's early in the startup ecosystem?
Yeah, really, really early. So we came, so I read this blog and it said what you needed to do was find a tech co-founder, 4 easy steps to startup success, find a tech co-founder, apply for an accelerator and, you know, get some, and then get an investor. And then you basically, you've made it and you can retire.
It's just as easy as that, isn't it?
And I was like, I can follow 4 simple steps. Watch me do this. So I signed up on LinkedIn. The first person I connected to was somebody I played Frisbee with, who was connected to somebody else who played Ultimate Frisbee, who was Roger Barnes, who's now one of the senior product managers at Atlassian. And for some reason, we just assumed that he was going to say yes. And I think he was kind of bewildered and he was like, I guess I have to say yes. And so we convinced him to join us as a co-founder. And then we pitched Startmate because I had to, you know, step 2 was to find an accelerator. There was 2 at the time. So it was Startmate and Push Start.
Yeah. This was super early. This would be Startmate's first year.
Yeah. It was the second. So they had just, what was the one that got acquired by Walmart?
Grabble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was just the year after Grabble. So this was the first cohort with Scriptrock was in there and Fox. And yeah, so we had applied and narrowly missed it because truthfully, we had no idea what we were doing. People asked us like, what's your customer acquisition cost? And I was like, come again? It's like, what's your CAC? Did you just swear at me? So it was a really, really interesting experience. But I think what it showed us was that there was this community here, which we didn't have up in Brisbane at the time. It was really, really small still there. And we ended up coming down here and, you know, pitching tent at Fishburners. And I ended up helping Kim Harris to run the Push Start Accelerator. And then here we are. And we just met the most amazing people through that. And I think we knew that we knew nothing. And we were just open to learning everything. Yeah. And I think that was one of the things that we had best to our advantage, was just being so completely naive and going like, we don't know. And we're just going to find the smartest people and ask them and get their advice and learn from that.
All right. So I'm desperate to hear the rest of the story. Like, how did it all play out?
So we didn't make it into either of the accelerators. So I was like, okay, well, might as well just skip step 2 then. So go straight to finding an investor. So through one of the advisors that we had through the network that we met here, one of the angel advisors, you know, ask for money and they give you advice. So we asked for advice and he ended up connecting us to one of his investor friends who was in Shanghai and really interested in that peer-to-peer travel space. So I flew to Shanghai, pitched this investor, and I don't know whether it was, you know, pity or admiration, but she was like, here's some money,
right,
go forth and get started. So we came back, got 2 interns on the team and try to make it work. We ended up having experiences in 16 countries. It was always really small. And I think we got our acquisition costs. We figured out what the model was and how do you make this the model work between, you know, demand and supply. But the truth of it is, like, the model is pretty bad. And for every, like, dollar you make, you lost $1.70.
Yeah.
Like, at the best that we got it. So we ended up going, this thing just doesn't work. No matter how many different business models we tried or experiments we ran, we were just really good with the data and went, this is just not a business here. It's a nice feature. If anybody's going to do it, it could be Airbnb because they already have the captive audiences on both sides. It's a nice little feature, not an actual business by itself. And then 2 years later, they did that. So I kind of feel good about it. It was like, we gave it a good shot and learned so much in the process and no regrets. Also don't regret that it probably didn't work out because...
Oh, you learn a lot from failure. You know, look,
failure. Yeah.
You
it's
know,
not a scary word.
You shouldn't be scared of that word. I mean, it's, I think Phil Moll talks about flearn, you know, fail fast and learn. What would you do differently if you had to do it again? Different idea?
No. Well, go all the how far back do we go? I think the one thing that I still have this niggling doubt about is whether we really went as deep with our customers as we could have. And I tend to pick this up now when I work with founders who are first getting started. I'm like, there is nowhere to hide from me if you're not doing your customer discovery and research properly. Like, you know, it's fine to sit and go, oh, I have the best idea and it could work. If only we build the product, build it and they will come. But, and to his credit, Roger was always pushing us, our CTO. He's like, I'm not doing a single line of code until you come back and bring me, you know, three customers that have said that they want this and actually put money on the table. So that's something that I really learned and almost painfully so, because I think what was my...
It's very informed for... I mean, I'm not saying that CTOs can't be commercial, but often CTOs, especially in startups, are not that commercial.
Yeah, he was special.
Right, good.
But yeah, so I think the thing that I just still think about now is, you know, if we had spent much more time really trying to hustle the customers and really understanding like the just layers and layers of depth to what their problems really were, maybe we would have figured it out differently. I don't think we would have, but yeah.
Yeah. All right. So that didn't quite work out, but at least you learned some fast lessons in a relatively short period of time. So what happened after that?
After that, I'm trying to think what the order of this was. So I worked with PushStart for a little bit during our program. And then I joined AutoGenie, which was through Alan Jones. So Alan Jones had a new agency at the time. Fun fact, you know, it's all connected. This is what I love about the ecosystem. It's all connected. But Alan Jones.
Yeah, Alan Jones is the linchpin though. Yeah. He's everything. I think he listens to this. So yeah, Al. Yeah. We love you.
Yeah, thanks, Al. So he connected me into that opportunity. I ended up taking on AutoGenie, which was a startup inside a bigger corporate. So it was within Smart Group. Devin Billiamora was the CEO at the time, and he really pushed the innovation agenda for
corporate. Yeah, we know Devin. He's such a good guy.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I, you know, when I think back now, I go, gosh, he was ahead of his time in terms of thinking about, you know, being able to risk, you know, cannibalizing his own business by virtue of building a business inside of it that, you know, could potentially be bigger. Turns out the market wasn't quite ready for that in Australia either. But so I was with AutoGenie for about a year and then joined Blue Chili as an entrepreneur in residence. I wanted to get back to a little bit more true startup roots.
Yeah.
So Seb, again, you know, Alan, I think, made the connection and Seb took a punt on me.
I think Alan was working there for a bit as well, wasn't he?
Yes. So that was right when new agency and Blue Chili merged acquired. Yeah. And so I kind of came along with that journey and joined when Catherine Eibner went on maternity leave. It was meant to be a 6-month come cover, you know, come work with the founders, make sure that they're not going off track, help them out. And then 6 months came and left and Catherine came back and they still kept paying me. And then I started dabbling in this, you know, trying to think, how do we bridge the startup and the corporate world? Because there's so much opportunity for startups, I think, in Australia specifically, to work with bigger enterprises and industry. And there's this gap that's missing and that was really missing at the time. Nobody was really addressing that. And so I tried to design all these programs, which then became, you know, corporate accelerators, for just trying to make them get on the same page and talk the same language so that we can benefit on both sides. So that startups can innovate faster by virtue of working with, enterprise can innovate faster by working with startups and startups could actually get better access to customers.
Yeah. And I know that's still a point of passion. And I want to touch on that, you know, with AWS hat on, but we'll maybe leave that till later because it's a big topic. I want to sort of explore the Blue Chili journey. I mean, I think everyone who's listening to this has probably heard of Blue Chili. Mm-hmm. I mean, Seb, Force of Nature, great guy. So tell us more about the Blue Chili journey, if you could, because you were there 6 years. I mean, yeah. It's a long time.
Yeah, 6 years. So I think when we started, we were less than, I think we were 12 startups. And I loosely say startups, when I started. And I think when I left, we were just under 150. So kind of walking that journey.
But the model changed over time. I mean, to start with, it was kind of like the original Pollinizer. It's like, we'll provide your tech dev and, you know, we'll take some equity. And, you know, so like, take us inside how it was all changing.
Yeah. I think like every business, you have to listen to your customers and you have to see what's changing in the market and then respond. And I think we were really good at doing that. We went through, I think, five iterations of business models, but I would call them three distinct phases. So the first one was the first model when I joined was we'll be your venture partner. We're basically going to take a chunk of equity in exchange for building your product. But there's also a payment that comes with that because you can't take enough equity to offset the risk. And that model, I think, was challenging because it didn't work on either side. You could not have enough equity to actually offset the risk. It used to, you know, end up about 20 or 30%. And it's not, when you think about subsequent raises or growth, it's really challenging for the founder to not have that equity with them themselves. And similarly, because the scope of work was, you know, determined as we went, it ended up that the costs ended up blowing out too. So the model just, it didn't really work on that front. So.
And it is hard to be an equity holder and charge fees essentially. And there's always, that was always my observation. It's just, I didn't think it was a bad model, but I just thought there was always this inherent conflict.
Yeah, challenges and conflict with that. But I think, you know, you got to start somewhere. And that's where we started. At the time, there was definitely a need for non-technical founders to at least launch some sort of a product into market to get to demonstrate that they could deliver on something. So I think there was a need for it. And then as the market changed and there were more co-working spaces, entrepreneurs were learning from each other faster. So we adapted and went, okay, well, if this couldn't be the model, then we could have this model where we worked and offset the cost of having a full engineering team to actually build these startups without charging them. We could offset that by building and doing some skunk works and innovation services to corporates. And that was the part that I helped to set up. And it was super exciting to be able to build that up, you know, from the early days and go, okay, great. Like, let's go and pitch this and get some customers. Westpac was one of the first ones that took a shot on us. And we ran a number of programs with Westpac in the end. And that model also worked for a certain period of time because then we could still work with entrepreneurs on an equity basis, which gave us a long-term upshot, but we could cover the cost. And then over time, that also, as we grew and we ended up being, I think, almost 50 people in the team, you know, and it's expensive to have engineers and talented people like we had. It was such a fantastic crew there.
But that's a big crew. I mean, you can hear the whooshing sound of the wage bill.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things that we were looking was for how do you diversify the revenue streams? So we ended up, the third iteration was where we worked with a global venture partner, Hatcher. And they essentially bought like a secondary, it was worked like a secondary. So we would work with the entrepreneurs at the start. Once they cleared the accelerator, so Hatcher certified, if you will, our process for getting successful startups at the other end. And then they would purchase a set of equity from us in exchange for revenue. So that was the third model that we ended up running and working with. We had some challenges with, you know, funds closing and delays and so on. But
Because I mean, I definitely got the perception in the last couple of years in particular, it was quite stressful. Internally. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what you...
Isn't it stressful running a startup and having to pay people?
I guess it is. And I don't know whether it was more stressful than otherwise, but it just seemed that it was hard.
Look, I think when I think back at that, it was a period of building out enormous resilience and character and trying to, you know, manage situations that I felt completely unprepared for. And it wasn't, you know, I'm not a co-founder. I was, you know, an exec in the company at that stage. So all the decisions come up to you and you have to basically just triage and put out fires wherever you can. And at the same time, have this positive, strong working culture, which I'm enormously proud of. I still think when I think about like the loyalty and support and, and passion of everybody in the team. And all of that was because they cared so much about the startups and the founders. So everything for us, I think essentially what sort of happened over the 6 years is more and more because, you know, and I also came with a founder hat and tried to drive that, but more and more we were focused on the customers and just going, what does a startup need? It's like our duty is to the startup. So we had this team that was just so aligned and passionate and capable and was just going, okay, we'll go above and beyond.
Yeah. And you're right about that passion. I mean, like I ended up recruiting Catherine Ibner and when I was in your role, and she's still on the team.
Yeah.
And she's great. I mean, she's, you know, you cut her down the middle, it just exhibits, you know, she bleeds startup passion. And, you know, I love that about her. And I think you're the same, from what I can see. So just maybe finishing in the corporate. So you had Westpac, I know you've done Stockland. I mean, there was quite a few corporates came into that sort of innovation. You know, I don't know whether you're calling it an incubator or accelerator, but.
It was an accelerator. So we ended up putting together these programs that would try and identify what the problem is that the corporate was trying to solve. Source and vet and boot camp the startups to as part of that selection process, make an investment and a commitment to helping them build their products. And then alongside that, we're doing a lot of work with the corporates to go on culture and mindset and capability. So kind of that transformation journey that they have to go through to go, oh, this is actually the pace. This is how you work with the startups. Here are some guardrails. Do not put them through, you know, 7,000 page document to go through. They're never going to come back. So there was a lot of, I think, training and just building a common language and a common infrastructure for them to actually understand how they could work together. And then very importantly, I think, was also building the relationships and the trust. So knowing when you had to invite which person from the company to come and attend which thing to see proof point of which, for which you can then 3 steps later have already understood how you were going to set them up to have a productive conversation that could actually lead to a proof of concept or a pilot.
Yeah. And so She Starts came out of that. So I want to touch on that. So tell us about She Starts.
So She Starts was, I recall this was on a rooftop in Brisbane with Wyatt Roy, who was the minister at the time, launching something that we did with CCIQ, which was one of the hubs that was when a lot of hubs and innovation and startup centers were building, and we were in Brisbane. And just previous to that, I had posted an article about one of our cohorts. It was one of our accelerators. and I said, oh, you know, announcing the new cohort. And I put it on Twitter, and I got called out on Twitter for not having more women. And I actually looked at it for the first time and went, oh gosh, there's one woman in here.
Out of what, 10?
Out of, you know, 10 or it was a cohort of, it was 10 entrepreneurs. And I went, oh, fuck.
Yeah. Like,
it just never really dawned on me because I never really paid attention to the structural biases and the way that the language that we used and the way that we portrayed entrepreneurs and how we talked about them and the heroes that we heralded. And I went, God, where are the women? You know, I always felt like this was a space that I could step into because I think stupidly stepped into it. My mom was a, you know, female engineer in a man's world, and it was in South Africa. And that was, so it never really occurred to me that I wouldn't be welcome anywhere. It was just like, oh, you just choose something different.
Yeah.
And that was a real eye opener. And I think it was on that rooftop and said, oh, you know, what if we have this like women's academy for entrepreneurship or women something? And I went, okay, that sounds all right. And then we met with Nicola Hazel there, who was a real force behind She Starts. And she went, yep, I'll come and join this crazy ship. I'll jump ship to startup world and be the program director for this program. And she was phenomenal in leading that and creating a real community and having a real view around what we could do different. And I think we all learned from each other in that process, you know, how do you bring more entrepreneurship into campaign? How do you bring more campaign into startup? How do you build this engine that became something that I'm just really, really proud of?
Yeah. And you should be, and you deserved, the success you've had with it. Innovation Bay, we got called out. You know, this must be 5 or 6 years ago, saying, you know, every time we come to a pitch event, it's all dudes and the room is full of dudes. You know, what are you going to do about it? And, you know, it's not until we got called out as well. We're like, holy crap, this is a problem. And then as soon as we publicly stated, well, we'll have at least one, but preferably two or three of our companies pitching will be a woman. We didn't have to go looking because just by making that public statement, more women applied. Yeah. And it's really important.
And I'm amazed that, you know, I think people often try and like really over-engineer it, but it's not that complicated. It's like you say, you make the statement, you're I think more cognizant of your language and the community that you build, or again, like the visual representation of diversity a little bit at the start, but it really comes down to, you know, like write the check.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can say all you want, but you know, write the check and make the hire.
Yeah. All right. So, and she starts, I mean, there were some pretty successful, I mean, like, can you name some of the successful companies that came out of there?
There's a couple that still, you know, come up regularly. One of them would be, Bindi Maps, which is the guided app for visually impaired. There's Neighborlytics, which is Jess and Lucinda down in Melbourne.
She pitched in one of our events and she was amazing.
Yeah. Claire Jenkins from Vet Chat, which is telehealth for vets, which I imagine during COVID would have been a godsend for a lot of pet owners. Sure. What else we had? Talkie Play. So Annie McCauley from Talkie Play, which is teaching kids with, you know, languages at an early age. And I just see such huge opportunity for, I guess, making the world a more connected, happier place. Yeah.
And so it's not just She Starts that you were involved with, but you're now currently and still involved with Heads Over Heels. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Heads Over Heels, I think, was one of the first organizations that I encountered when I showed up in the Big Smoke in Sydney. And Melissa Widner was at one of the events, and I was talking about, because I was basically just doing the rounds, pitching my startup to anybody who would listen. Yeah. And she listened and she said, oh, maybe you should, you know, take a look and come along to one of the events and just learn a little bit more. And I went to one of the events and I was just blown away. So Heads Over Heels is a not-for-profit organization that supports high potential female CEOs of high growth startups. And they don't provide funding. It's not pitching for funding. It's basically making the connection between very well connected business decision makers, you know, so it would be executives and senior level execs at big enterprises, and you get everybody together in a room, and then the entrepreneurs, the female founders, are pitching for connections. Yeah. One of the challenges that we're trying to address with the organization is that oftentimes in a predominantly male business environment, women often don't have the same networks.
Yeah.
So it helps to know people, get a warm introduction. This happens everywhere. So it's kind of breaking the bias and breaking the glass ceiling.
And I've got to say, I love how they do it. I mean, I go to the events. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy it. Andrea, my other half and partner at Gelix, has been and pitched there as well. And they kind of play to the audience, like what they know the audience wants. You know, one, they want to help, but two, they kind of gamify it to the point of making it a little bit competitive. So it's like, who's got a connection? And publicly, you got to put up your hand and say, well, I can introduce you to the boss of Virgin or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that means that the snowball just rolls, you know, so mm-hmm. you've only got 7 minutes to do it. And I just find it amazing just how many people give. And, I sort of feel for the founders off the back of that, because it's like, bloody hell, you got 2 weeks of follow-ups to do off the back of this one event.
Got, you know, 60 or 80 offers of introductions. Yeah. I think it's just phenomenally powerful. And I think when you think about the outcomes, oftentimes those introductions are worth far more than some of the money that you would have been able to raise if at a seed round or Series A. So I love it. And I think it's, to me, it just represents everything that's good and positive and optimistic about the world, is that generosity of people to help each other.
All right, look, we're 25 minutes in and we haven't really talked about AWS, and I do want to hear more about it, because as I said, I was in the role. I loved it. I loved the ability to help. I loved the focus we had on the founders themselves and not just trying to sell them stuff. There was so much good about it. So how did the job come around for you?
So I finished up with Blue Chili in December and then decided I was going to take a couple of months off.
So this is December 2019. All right, so a year and a bit ago.
So a year and a bit ago, I finished up, said I was going to take some time off. I was trying to think about, how do I have, you know, my next impact on the world. I wasn't quite sure if I was going to fully stay in startups. It's been, you know, 10 years.
Yeah.
And I was really thinking about, how do I participate in something that has a positive impact on climate, was actually what I was thinking about at the time. And then I got an outreach from one of the exec recruiters at AWS, and he said, I have this fantastic role. I think, you know, probably Matt and Catherine may have had something to do with highlighting my availability. But yeah, it was sort of a surprise. And he said, we've got this role. Do you want to talk about it? And I said, oh, fine. I'll talk about everything right now. I'm not even looking yet. Yeah. And I realized that this was the role that Rachel had at the time and you previously held. And I just always thought that what a phenomenal opportunity, you know, when I think back over my career so far, and it was, you know, one startup and then 10 startups with Push Start Accelerator and then 150 with Blue Chili. It's sort of like that 10X factor. And when I realized the scale, and I always recall when, you know, Catherine told me about, you know, how phenomenal it was to be in the AWS universe. And she always just talked about all the startups that we had never seen before, you know, where we looked at it in our accelerator view. And she said, you know, it's phenomenal to see the companies, and that you're really going to enjoy it because you can really see how the world can be different.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I used to talk about the, you know, it's not a sales job really. I mean, it's called business development. So ultimately you want customers to be using AWS services. But the focus is not necessarily on that. It's more on, you know, and the way I used to put it is if you go out and create 1,000 new startups, then a percentage of them, you know, half say, are going to end up being AWS customers. So therefore go out and help encourage more startups to be formed. And it was beautiful. It was just this really positive look at the ecosystem.
Yeah. And I think for me, I'm very impact driven. So I do want to know that it will make a positive impact on the ecosystem, like the ecosystem itself, and just, which is, you know, nebulous and connected and ever evolving. But it's something that I just so passionately care about, because for me, that was a thing that tipped my life over into startups. And it's almost like if you see Grayscale before and then you suddenly see Technicolor, that's for me what happened when we started our startup. It's not that I didn't like my life before. I just really did not see all the colors of the world. And so to be able to support that ecosystem through, you know, through the partnerships that we have with VCs and angels and accelerators and incubators, and then also through the work that we do get to do one-on-one with some of the startups, I think it's just phenomenal to be able to have that impact and to grow it. And when I looked at this and I thought, you know, why do this with AWS? I mean, you helping Fishburners back in the day, you know, you're part of the reason why me and my peers were able to very quickly start and scale. You know, the credits that you provided, the fact that you brought the community together around pitch events, which we never had before. You bought our beer. Thank you very much.
Don't forget the pizza.
But I think it's, you know, things like that, I think, are often underestimated. It's like bringing a community together. It's like those connections that you form, how you learn from each other, the learning velocity within the startup ecosystem, you can't find that anywhere else. You know, people are hyper-connected. They're all trying to learn. They're all trying to improve. And sometimes all it takes is a catalyst to bring and enable some of those events to occur, or meetings to happen, or, you know, communities to form. And that's something that I'm still trying to grow and promote now. Even when we think that the ecosystem has grown up, there's still so much for us to do and so much opportunity.
Yeah. There's a lot that I miss about the role. One was the paycheck. Paycheck was good. The second one was the team. I mean, like, you get to work with the most amazing people. And I know you've still got Catherine, but I mean, who else is on your team, and how do you think about them?
Catherine's actually, she's now taken the startup mentality into the public sector. So she's running the Center for Innovation in the Cloud.
Which is great. It's phenomenal. Great move for her.
Which is great, because now every time that we have, you know, a startup that is kind of public sector, you know, government related or education related, I'm like, Catherine, here's one. Please take good care of them.
Yeah.
So no, it's fantastic. So we've got a couple of people on the team now. Our team has grown quite a bit since I think it was you and Rachel and Catherine and Matt. So we've got a few people all over Australia and New Zealand now within the BD team. So these are generally the folks that you'd see out at the events, and they'll be very much part of the ecosystem. And we're not there to sell. We're there to, like you said, build the community. We have a whole team of account managers now who look after specifically just startups. It's a very new thing for us. We just hired a bunch of people last year. We've got a couple of open roles. So if you are looking, we're hiring account managers in Sydney and in Brisbane. So please go take a look.
Where'd you go? Jobs.amazon.com? Is that it?
Sure. I'm sure if you're resourceful, this is the first secret to clearing the loop is you got to be resourceful. So go find it.
Yeah.
It's on my LinkedIn, so you can look it up. I posted on my LinkedIn a little bit earlier.
Another tip if you are looking is like read and memorize the leadership principles because I'll ask you all about them.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a tip.
There's a whole, I guess, you know, the hiring process is pretty phenomenal here. So we've got solution architects, so people who are actually technical and can work with the startups and provide them advice on their, you know, their kind of forward thinking about their roadmap and whether they're actually setting up their architecture in the right way. So we now have this force of, can't say the number, but you know, couple of tens people here, and it's just phenomenal to be part of that team.
Oh, it's great. Like, and I don't know all of them, but whenever I interact with them, I'm like, wow, you guys are good, which, you know, it doesn't surprise me. It kind of gives me a bit of a buzz because, you know, that used to just be me. I mean, it was when I joined, it was literally just me and I was the player manager. And I loved that.
You proved the pilot though. So I think we all have to thank you for the opportunity that we now have.
And I got to say, I kind of think I got the best of all of it because, you know, the global team, you know, we used to go and hang out in Tokyo and London and New York and, you know, just drink a bit and have a lot of fun together. And, you know, the travel's all locked down and, you know, we were hanging out with startups and the VCs. And now, I don't know, it's a little bit different.
It definitely is. So I started the week Amazon went virtual, right? Work from home. So it was a really interesting experience doing things like finding your laptop. Or just simple things that you think would just normally be done when you're sitting down in an onboarding session in an office and suddenly going, okay, great. So good luck. We'll check on you again in 8 hours. have fun. Learn and be curious. But I do really look forward. I have to say, I cannot wait to, I still haven't met most of the people on my team, on my direct team, wow, let alone the extended startup team, let alone anybody outside of, you know, Australia. So I really look forward to just that opportunity to meet them face to face and see how tall they are or like if they're...
And do they have legs?
Do that. I mean, this is the world. I am not a dog. Yeah. I'm not a cat, Your Honor, I swear.
So, I mean, there's two things that you kind of focus on when you're thinking about your customers or the startups you work with. So, I mean, one is the technical aspects. I mean, AWS by its nature is, you know, Amazon Web Services. I mean, the clue's in the name. I mean, it's highly technical and it's got a huge number of products and services. That's the first thing. And I want to ask you about that. But the second thing is the commercial aspect. So, and you kind of, you know, I was the same as you. I wasn't technically, I couldn't code to save my life, unless I suppose I had to and you had to learn it. You kind of think you could do everything, you know, so we'd get wheeled in to talk about fundraising and go to market and all those other good things. But there's an amazing technical team that rolls in behind it. So, you know, tell us about the technical side then.
Yeah. So when I looked at, you know, should I jump ship and come to AWS, I did do some due diligence and speak to some of my favorite and most respected CTOs that I knew and just all around the feedback that I got was, you know, AWS is a fantastic and what's a word that I can't say?
Default?
No? Let's go with default.
Okay.
It's a fantastic product and it's unparalleled in some of its technical capabilities. And that really gave me a lot of confidence that it's not, you know, if I'm there representing a company or a capability, I want to make sure that it, even if I'm not the technical person, that I'm not just selling snake oil. And I think for me, that was really the thing that made me go, yeah, okay, I could definitely do this both from the impact side, but also because I could really believe in the product. It's got, you know, I think we've got over 170 different technical products. How many were there when you were here?
When I left, it was 59.
59.
And when it started, it was just compute, storage, database. It was three.
Oh, gosh.
You know, so it's unbelievable now. And some of the, you know, I struggle to stay up to speed with it. And I don't know how you go now because, you know, you're sitting looking at your email and every day you'd get two or three announcements of new products coming out.
And a company like Amazon, where innovation is so baked into the culture and the DNA, it's, you know, you don't need approvals to go and experiment. And, you know, you write your PR FAQ, then you write your narrative, you know, your two pager and then your six pager, and then you socialize it. And if nobody stops you, go forth and go build this thing and create this product. So I'm not surprised that we have this many, but, you know, we're doing a lot of fantastic things in AI and ML right now. And especially, I think SageMaker is a really interesting product to go and look at if you're a startup, because it helps you to automate the entire build and flow and deployment of your models. So I think that's something that really excited me for startups and just seeing how that could help accelerate their AI journeys. We're doing fantastic things with computer vision and edge and IoT now, which when you're thinking about agriculture and agri-tech, I think there's so much opportunity for us to leverage that and to bring the, both the technology and then the entrepreneurs together and go, okay, great. Let's solve some really chunky problems.
Yeah.
Like how do you feed 10 billion people?
That's a big problem.
Yeah.
Let's maybe jump back then to the commercial aspect and what you can do to help. And, you know, let's go back to what I said we talk about, which is your sort of passion project. So how do you become a better interface between corporates who need innovation and struggle, to be honest, to interface with startups? Because it's just, you know, the corporates aren't designed to do that really. And startups who want to sell to these big corporates, because if you can crack this holy grail, then it's just incredible. So like, how are you thinking about this one?
I think it's one of the things that the from just the teams that I've met, you know, we're very uniquely positioned to help make this happen for startups. So there's a innovation advisory team that are looking at a program that basically brings together the corporates and the startups. So I'm working from the startup side to try and figure out what all the different programmatic elements are so that we can scale it. You know, it's fantastic if you can do it once. Like, it's not hard to make an introduction, let's be honest. You know, it's like you got to know, you just have to know two people to make an introduction. So I'm surprised not more people do this, but you have to know two people and have a reason and go, oh, great, you have this opportunity and you have this need and you make the introduction. And then it's not always up to you to make something of an outcome from it. You know, the entrepreneur has to drive that, the corporate has to actually, you know, put the money in, but you facilitate that. But how do you do that at scale?
Yeah.
And, you know, when I think about the Amazon culture and philosophies around mechanizing things and building mechanisms, because without mechanisms, you know, Jeff Bezos said that it's just all good intent. So I could have the intent to make 100 introductions for
everyone
startups.
Everyone has good intentions.
Yeah, but how do you mechanize that? So that's one of my big think big ideas, as it's called. So my think big ideas, I'm going to crack this nut. I feel like that's a skill set that I bring from both the experience with doing that with Blue Chili, but also having been on the internal side doing a startup inside a corporate and having gone through the journey of doing a startup. I just like, I have to do this.
Yeah. Look, I want, you know, if there's anything we can do to help, because, you know, it was when I was leaving, it was kind of the thing that I wanted to try and crack, but it was really, really hard. You know, and in some ways, it is a double-sided marketplace. You've got your corporates and you've got your startups and you're trying to build a marketplace between them. And in any double-sided marketplace, you've got a constraint. And I think the constraint here is on the corporates. Like how, so I'll maybe ask you this, like how do you get to the right person or the right people or the right team or whoever it is within the corporate and try and convince them that they should be interfacing with startups? Like what language are you using?
I think, you know, just broadly, like macro looking at this, the time for, you know, innovation and transformation, if it wasn't 2020, when was it?
Yeah.
You know, that little joke around, you know, what accelerated your digital transformation? Was it, you know, your CTO, your CDO, your CIO, or COVID? So so many companies, Andy Jassy, our CEO, has said that many times. That
soon to be Amazon CEO.
Soon to be.
CEO, yeah.
Well, when I say our, now I can just say our and not have to distinguish anymore. But, you know, he's reiterated again, just at reInvent recently, that it's only, you know, when you think about the opportunity in cloud and the opportunity for, you know, computing and digital transformation, only 4% of companies are on the cloud so far. So
4%, that's not many.
Doesn't that just blow your mind?
Yeah.
Like, and I go, surely somebody did not do their research right. But no, this has been fact-checked and cross-checked. But so 96% of, you know, enterprises and business and small business aren't operating on the cloud yet. And that is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
To think that that could even be possible. And this is when you compare that to startups and just like the rate and the pace of digital adoption and innovation and the ability to rapidly iterate and move fast and, you know, break something, turn it off, turn it on, you know, a service. You don't have to set up an entire server farm before you can even publish your website. It's like click your fingers and it's ready and you can turn it off and on. And I think that's just like the power when you think about how startups are doing it. You go, imagine if the whole world could innovate at this pace. So
wearing your startup hat then, like, would you rather be talking to the 96% that are not in the cloud in terms of trying to encourage them, you know, you've got to think, you know, think innovatively and, you know, look at all these cool startups and that will encourage you to get on the cloud? Or would you rather talk to the 4% that you know are already engaged? I mean, which one's easier?
You mean from an enterprise side?
Yeah, enterprise.
It depends on the need. Think back to when I actually had to do that. It depends on whether, you know, are their share prices usually one of those things? Is it going up? Is it going down? You know, there's different reasons for why you would innovate and where you are in that innovation curve, you know, your journey as a corporate. Sometimes you need to do some of the culture and the evangelizing and the scene setting before you can get to action. Right. Sometimes you need to take action to force people into seeing a different way. So it really depends on the company itself. But who would I rather be talking to? I would rather be talking to startups.
Right.
Let's be honest.
Yeah.
I don't need to convince them to come over to the dark side.
So does that mean that there's going to be, like, as part of your grand initiative, like a separate team that's going to be interfacing with the corporates and trying to convince them?
Yeah. So it's just interlocking. I think that's one thing that I learned from Amazon is there are so many different teams. You know, I feel like I'm reminded of when I was in Tokyo and I couldn't figure out where the center of Tokyo was. And I was just walking around and going like, am I here yet? And I was so confused. And that's almost how I felt when I first started. And especially because I was just basically pacing around in my, you know, living room, trying to figure out if I was in Tokyo. But yeah, there's teams that are real specialists, whether it's technical specialists or whether it's, you know, enterprise teams or whether it's innovation teams. And it's not always that you have to do things yourself. And this is how you end up scaling yourself. You don't have to do everything. You have to figure out who does what and then bring them together to solve a problem.
Yeah.
So I think the problem that we're trying to solve is how do we make that connection happen where both sides actually walk away and go, yeah, I got something out of that.
All right, we've got time for maybe one more theme or question here. So Innovation Bay put on an event this week on the seed funding gap. So you were there.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, in the crowd, we had a physical event. So it was, well, a hybrid event, we're calling it. So we had 30 people in the crowd at Macquarie, our sponsor, and 120, I think, joined us online, which was great. But one of the themes that came up when we were talking about why is there a seed funding gap was a sort of lack of data within the startup ecosystem. So especially around that early stage. So like, how do you get angels to disclose their investments and startups to announce it? And there's no Crunchbase or Mattermark in Australia. You know, and I remember when I was in your role, it was like, this is bad, we should solve it.
This is bad, we should solve it.
I know. And every time I talk about it, I'm like, wow, this is like, someone's got to crack this. But, you know, how big a problem is this and how do you think it should be solved?
I feel like there's a little bit of wonder, you know, like a little bit of wonder and beauty in the fact that we don't have a clear picture. I think it would be hard because when you think about what's important for a startup, it's speed and it's customers and, you know, like executing. Like, it's not about filling in paperwork and providing 20 different data sets and a blood sample, right? You know, startups, I think it's very dynamic. It comes and it goes. So even if you had a snapshot in time, it will probably be different tomorrow. It's not like the ASX, right? It takes years to overhaul or change. So I think it would be, so many of us think that it would actually be remarkably beneficial because, you know, you could have a database of startups and go, here's all the startups, this is what they're doing. And then therefore these are the corporates and you can bring them together, for example, and say, oh, great. It's just a matchmaking. Just get the blockchain to do it. Right. but I do think that the one thing that I've noticed over time is, you know, with the, with data sets, like when Startup Muster was running, their reports. And then when Startup Oz is now doing, you know, a lot of thorough, the Crossroads report, I think is remarkable. And what it does is, it's not necessary that we need to know exactly what happens with every single startup. But when you look at the trends over time, you know, 10 years ago to now, there are 10 times more VCs. There are 10 times more accelerators and incubators. I don't quite know if there were 10 times more because we didn't count them back then, but I'm just going to say there's 10 times more startups.
Yeah.
And I think what it does is when we're trying to position what the startup economy means for our broader economy and why it's important to support and why it's important to create opportunities and to, you know, put funding into hubs and precincts, that's where it becomes really, really important for us to have that data.
So how do we solve it though?
How do you solve it? There are, I mean, we've got data sets, like you've got, you know, Crunchbase, which only, you know, it's not complete because it only looks at funded startups and only, you know, less than 10% of startups get funding. So what happened to the other 90? We have data sets like Tech Board in Western Australia. There's PitchBook. So there's databases everywhere, but none of them are complete, and I don't know how you would solve it. You know, national survey.
I know. Look, it's really hard.
Startup genome. It's voluntary.
Because ultimately, the way to solve it is just to have humans making phone calls and doing just deep research, which just by the time you scale it out with the number of humans you need, it's like, this is really expensive.
Yeah, but it's also subjective. You know, am I a startup?
Like, true.
Like, am I a small business? Am I a digitally enabled business? Yeah. Am I an app? Am I a startup?
Yeah.
Right. So how you define startups and how you, I think makes a massive difference. So you just by changing the parameters, you could see a 20% increase or decrease the next year.
All right. Let's not go too far down that rabbit hole anymore then. We didn't talk about Activate. So, I mean, that's one of the sort of main weapons in your armory, if that's the right expression, in terms of how you interface with startups and help them. So what is Activate and how should the startups listening deal with it?
Yeah.
Think about it.
So there's a number of programs that we've put together. You know, the startup team and the BD team especially are all, you know, former founders and operators and investors. And we've walked that startup journey and we know what startups need at different stages. So we have different programs that support startups at different stages, you know, and one of the most well-known and loved is the Activate program. And that's a program where, you know, if you're a startup right now in your bedroom, you can go and sign up for $1,000 in cloud credits. So if you just need to go and get something launched, there's $1,000 for you to get started. We want to make it faster and easier and remove as many barriers for people getting started and launching their startups. And then as you scale through the program, so Activate as training, there's an online console where you can go and find all the information about, you know, how do I do this or what sort of architecture is best for this. We also provide go-to-market support for later stage companies. So at the time when it is right for them to be working with an enterprise or a channel partner, we would introduce them to those channel partners and those enterprise customers later on in their life cycle through the connections program. We have a number of programs that help startups, you know, experiment and test whether it's a proof of concept for testing a new service. Like, let's say you guys don't really know if this AI service is really for me. We can support them and provide some credits additionally for them to go and experiment a little bit. So we really try and bring that culture of it's okay to test things. It's okay to experiment. And we don't want you to have to do it with a lot of risk. We know that startups have other things to worry about. So if we can get started and do that, that's great. So if you're a startup listening now, go sign up for Activate.
And there's training as well. So, I mean, if you're not technically minded, you can get up the learning curve quite quickly.
Yeah.
Which I think is also great.
Yeah. And then we also offer particular additional, you know, programs and support for our partners. So whether it's an accelerator or a startup training program or a VC, we'll do specific trainings or sessions or, executive communities, like founder communities that we support for them. So it's amazing work. And when I think about the work that the team does, I'm like, I know why every person in AWS wants to be on the startup PD team now. So
yeah,
it's phenomenal.
That is a great job. Quick fire questions. I think I gave you a heads up in this one. Sometimes I just, ambush the guest, but you have had some heads up. So tell us about your favorite book.
The Alchemist.
Okay.
I've reread that 3 times at various points.
And is it that I'm not aware of this one? Fiction, non-fiction? What is it?
It's a fiction book, but it's one of those, like, you know, life and meta, the guy who goes looking for gold and looks for the guy who turns things into gold. But it's not for me, what that is all about. He doesn't find it in the end, but he does find something that's far more precious. And I think that's a good reminder every time that I read it. It's not just about the outcome. It's not, it's not the outcome. It's actually the journey that you go on.
Right.
And there's value in all of it rather than just obsessing about whether it was a success by somebody else's definition of success.
Right. I don't think I've ever read a book 3 times, so it must be good.
Yeah, I really like every 10 years. I'm that old.
No, you're not. Do you have a favorite podcast?
I don't actually listen to as I'm getting back into podcasts now, but the one that I always keep coming back to is, of course, Innovation Bay and Masters of Scale with Reid Hoffman. I just love how they dig into the psychology and the mindset of some of the founders and love listening to how they explain, you know, concepts or problems in the world. So that one.
Yeah. And it's very polished, very well produced.
Yes.
I do quite like that about it. It makes me wonder whether we should polish ours some more.
You need some more jingles.
Yeah. You need more jingles. Okay. I did think that. All right. We'll do that. Do you have a favorite news source? What do you lean on to find out what's going on?
locally. So I'm an AFR subscriber, so I get that.
Yeah, I love that. So good.
And there's good journalism in there. And I think what's exciting too is I've started reading it more and more the more that they write about startups.
Yeah.
And so it's really good to see these small little companies now in our main publication. So I do read that for finding out what's happening locally. And then I just kind of come across things on Medium. Like I'm a Medium reader.
And do you think like who else in the local startup community is doing a good job of news coverage? Startup Daily? I mean, they've got Ozbiz, you know, they do the little TV show.
I'm just going to go with, I'll tell you the actual way that I read and digest news these days. Mark, it's Marsley on my team. I don't know how many, you know, Google alerts or whatever he's got set up, but we have a news channel, a Slack channel. And every morning I basically just go there and see what did I have to read about what's happening in the startup world. So whatever is in my Slack channel from Mark, thank you very much, Mark. Well, that's my news feed.
If Mark's listening, there's a think big idea, buddy. It's like make that into a newsletter for the community because we kind of need it. Like Paul Bennett was a partner at Airtree and then joined Spaceship. Mm-hmm. He had a daily digest. Do you remember? Mm,
yeah, that's
and
right.
And it kind of got busy and it went away and it's not been replaced. So we need another one.
Good Mark. One. I reckon Mark would love that.
All right. Come on, Mark. Pull your finger out. Or Colette will have words.
He's busy. He's busy helping startups.
Do you have a favorite tech CEO?
I was really impressed last year with Dr. Sylvia Pfeiffer from CoView.
She's
and
great.
I know it's not a, you know, it's not an Airbnb unicorn, not yet. But the thing that was really impressive for me was, you know, I met Sylvia years ago with Heads Over Heels, you know, so it's not just as if she was suddenly just an overnight success. You know, she's been at this for a really long time working in telehealth, right? So telehealth consultation platform. And she was one of the first creators of video standards for the internet.
Yeah.
Right. So if it weren't for the work that she put in, like we wouldn't have the same, we wouldn't be using Netflix and YouTube the way that we do.
She was deeply technical in video.
Yeah.
Because I met her, I think 12, 13 years ago when I was running ViCorp. And I was blown away with just how smart this woman was.
Yeah.
And just been following ever since. And now she's not just turned this technically super competentness into a great CEO, but she's building a great business.
Yeah. And last year, you know, especially with COVID, just it's not like, you know, scale is not easy and going through growth is not easy and being a CEO is not easy and being, in that position for that long. And then to experience this moment where suddenly the world flips and you go from, you know, in day one, 400 consultations, day two, 25,000.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like, yeah, it's amazing.
How do you hire? How do you manage? How do you communicate? It's like, I'm just really impressed by how she's handled that.
And she actually joined Summit, you know, our club for Series A and beyond startups. She's one of our recent intake and she's been amazing.
Yeah.
She's in the clan with a few other amazing CEOs like Olympia from Gotera and who else is in there? Paul from Foodbot. I mean, there's some great, great people in that group and she is right up at the top there. So yeah, glad you said that.
Yeah.
Favorite app? So when you've launched your phone, I hope you don't say Gmail or, well, actually you don't have Outlook. that's the wrong answer, just by the way.
My family's all over the world, so I can't not look at WhatsApp first thing in the morning. And they're now during COVID have gone completely berserk. So now I have like 27 messages every time I wake up. But, my current favorite is actually an app called Picture This. So I've become a bit of a plant lady during COVID.
There's a few plants around the place. Yeah.
They're all potted, by the way.
They're beautiful.
So it looks like a garden, but it's just pots. So Picture This is an identification app for plants. So you basically just walk up and hold it up to the plant and then
that's cool.
Take a picture and it tells you what plant it is. And then, you know, I save them in little collections and you kind of start figuring out how you care for them better. Strange.
Wow. No, there's nothing strange about that.
I didn't know what half of these things were called. It was like, it's a plant. It's green.
And is it pretty accurate?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's amazing.
It's amazing.
Productivity tool. Tell us a secret because you get a lot of email in that job. I know that.
See, my productivity tool for that is just ignore it. So if you send me an email, good luck. I'm actually really impressed by Notiv.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard a few people say that.
Yeah, recording and transcribing meetings.
Notiv, not Notion. Yeah,
Notiv.
I've heard of Notiv. Yeah, so tell us about that.
So when you're running a meeting, you can have the Notiv app run on the side, and it basically records and then transcribes, but it also listens for things like when you make a decision or when you have an action or a follow-up or you direct somebody to do something, and it'll kind of flag it for you on the side and go, oh, this was a decision that we made was this, or a follow-up action is this, which just means that when you look back at your meeting notes, A, they're not just scribbles like you have in my notebook here. Yeah, yeah. They're actually, you know, they're searchable. They're very well organized, and you can just go back and, oh, that's what we had to do. So it means that the next time that you have the follow-up meeting, you go very quickly, oh, yeah, I should have done that action.
Yeah, and it's an Aussie company, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, at Brisbane, I believe.
I think it's Brisbane, yes.
Yeah, I think we met the CEO last year or 2 years ago. Yeah, great, great story, that one. Does it understand South African and Scottish?
Let's try.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll throw this podcast out and see how it does. Last question, favorite TV show? I'm just looking at your living room. You have a very small telly with a huge Sonos soundbar underneath. It's an interesting setup.
I try, you know, before we had kids, there was like a good 8 year period. And this was like in the depth of the startup world. We just didn't have a TV. We didn't watch TV, didn't care for it. Then we had a kid and you're like, could you just please sit still and watch fucking cartoons? So now we have a TV, but it is still small. I'd say I'm not really a TV watcher, but I got really into The Queen's Gambit.
Oh, yeah.
On Netflix. I was a chess player in school.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah. I wasn't.
I can see you in that show.
I could see me in that show too. It's like, who doesn't want to go like partying all night and play chess all day?
Yeah, that sounds really cool. Yeah. So you watched it on this TV here?
Yeah, this enormously big TV.
Yeah, you know, big TVs are pretty cheap. Might be time to.
But I have one. And this is, this is where my greenie comes out. I'm like, but I have one and it's not broken. So why do I need a bigger one? It's fine. You're making it sound like it's a shoebox.
No, it's not. It's a beautiful house, by the way. It's just your telly's too small.
Okay. I have a
maybe
life.
That's a dude thing. I don't know. Like, dudes seem to like big tellies. I don't know whether that's true or not.
Yeah. Well, we're okay.
Who knows? All right, last, final question. If you were asked to do a TED talk by someone, what would you talk about?
Oh, God. I don't have an answer for you.
Yeah, well, what do you think?
What do you think I should talk about?
I don't know, like plants or, you know, not necessarily, you know, startups is kind of the easy answer. So it's kind of going to be what, you know, deep down is your passion for.
Yeah. I'm really interested in how do you change public perception in people's minds around particular things that I care about, like the environment. So how do we change, if we can find a way to change the politicized agenda around, you know, climate change, where it's not just around, do I believe it is or it isn't, versus like, how do you create a different future?
Yeah.
Now, whether or not I'm qualified to talk on a TED talk about that is very different to what I would want to talk about, but I guess that's an area that I could.
I think it's a super important issue. And, you know, it's weird in Australia where it's been pushed so far down the political agenda. It's just, and it's, I don't know. I really strongly object. And I love what people like Zali Stigall and a few others are doing around that, just drawing attention to it. It's terrible what Australia's policy here is.
There's a fantastic book called Blackout, and I just forgot his last name, Matthew. It's by a guy named Matthew. The book is Blackout, and it goes through the history of electricity and then henceforth climate conversations, like energy. It's basically around energy in Australia. And I read that and it just, for me, went, oh, wow, this is why we think the way that we do, which was usually insightful as to how could we think differently. And one of the areas that particularly, you know, when I think about the ability that I have with this role to shape the ecosystem and to support it and to guide it in a particular direction, you know, I'm very much intentionally, and I'm very open about this, that I'm trying to build an ecosystem that is more inclusive and sustainable and highly, highly innovative as a precursor to those two things. And, you know, so I'm looking at energy startups, and I'm looking at startups that are working in the climate space and trying to figure out how do I support them better? Yeah. And I was really, really excited when I first joined. I think it was right when I started. I think it might have even been the week that I started that they announced the Climate Pledge Fund. So Jeff Bezos launched the $2 billion Climate Pledge Fund, and they're investing in energy and energy storage and renewables and anything that reduces the amount of carbon and has a positive climate impact is now on the table. And I went, right on. Come on, Australia.
Is that Amazon or is that Jeff Bezos?
It's the Amazon. So it's the Climate Fund, Climate Pledge Fund.
Yeah, and I think they just ordered a whole, every delivery truck is going to be electric. Is that right?
Yeah, I did read that right.
Yeah, that's very cool.
And that is just huge. When you think of the scale, the impact that this company can have at that scale, it is mind blowing. So if I have one ask, I would ask if you are working in, if you're aligned on this vision that we could build this world, then reach out to me and say hi and tell me about your startup.
Yeah. That's a great place to stop, Colette. So look, thank you. That was a lot of fun. I always learn stuff about people I think I know well, but I've learned more today. So, and if someone wants to get hold of you, what's the best way?
You can try me. You can try me on email, but you know that I don't read it.
Twitter.
Yeah, I'm on. LinkedIn's pretty good. So
LinkedIn or Twitter.
Yeah, LinkedIn or Twitter is a pretty good one.
GRGIC.
That's the one.
All right.
It doesn't miss vowels. It's spelled like that.
I love it. All right, Colette. Thank you so much. That was awesome.
And, thanks.
Yeah. Thanks everyone for listening.
Cheers. Bye.